This is episode 51 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and welcome to Geek Speak. With me in the impromptu studio is Mr. Miles Elam. Of course, you know him as a pedant, a software developer, curmudgeon, and a political junkie. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
I wasn't sure if I could get through that list correctly, looking at you. You're very charming today. Are you cold in this space or you're gay?
I'm fine. I feel great.
We're actually recording from downtown Ben Lomond, where there's a community center called Park Hall, and both Miles and I have been on stage in this building and been performers.
Oh, yeah. That was a long time ago.
Yeah. You were good. As I walked in, I'm like, does Miles know how to get here? Oh, yeah. He was in a play here. So there's auditions.
And dated someone here.
There's auditions on Monday. So you can audition for a play if you want.
Oh, okay.
Next Monday.
Good.
You want to do that? I was thinking about it. I went and saw the show that just closed. Mark Peter closed the show. Other Desert Cities. If you have a chance to see the play Other Desert Cities, you can't see this one because it's closed. It was fantastically good. It's a little bit, it's kind of during the Second Iraq War. It's placed, and it's about family with a lot of secrets. Parents are staunch Republicans and the kids are not, and the debate. And it was just so nice to see theater that, you know, theater traditionally has had a political agenda. And has mean something in the world. That's the history of theater in a lot of ways. And so it was neat to see that. Anyway, okay, on with Geek Speak. We have a correction from last week, or I should say yesterday, because I just put up last week's show very late. And therefore, if you didn't catch last week's show and you don't know what I'm talking about here, make sure your podcast feed catches last week's show. We talked about credit card numbers being guessed. Do you recall that story, Mom?
Yes, I do.
And the idea, well, you can listen to last week's episode, but we...
Or yesterday's episode.
Yes. We presented it as credit cards in general, but actually it's the Visa credit card credit cards that can be guessed.
Yeah, it's only the largest credit card company.
And I'm assuming that's because as the, you know, we're talking about why how they could do this better, in other cards like MasterCard's probably is doing it better, right?
Apparently MasterCard is doing it better. They do keep a running counter.
Of how many failed attempts happen.
Yeah.
So Visa really just needs to implement that and then it's fine. But for now, make sure you check your
Well, that's
your
how Visa got so big. They just skip all of those little niggling details.
Pesky security and vulnerability concerns. All right. And you go ahead and have an update about Netgear or a warning.
Yes. Security researchers are recommending that if you have one of several Netgear router models, Netgear being a manufacturer of consumer-grade
network security gear for the home. Yes.
Yeah. Network security gear usually means that it increases security.
I'm sorry, network hardware for the home.
But there is a critical bug that if you have one of these devices, and you can go read the story from our website, that it would allow unfettered access to your home network.
Not good.
From the outside, which is kind of the point behind the device is to not allow that to happen.
So, and this is Netgear with the default BIOS that come from the company because the BIOS has a vulnerability.
Right. But okay. It's the firmware, as of when we've recorded this, has not been updated yet. There is no fix for it.
Not good. So what would you recommend at this point if you got one of those as your front end to the network?
I would suggest buying a whole new brand.
What about installing something like Tomato?
Not all Netgear devices will support that. If it does, that's still a bit of a push. And chances are, if you are well versed and comfortable enough with computers to install Tomato or DDWRT or OpenWRT, one of those custom firmwares, you probably didn't buy one of these Netgear devices,
right?
They are reasonably cheap, especially if you buy one used. And say you went up to Amazon or Craigslist or whatever, they are available, and you can get one that's just a generic,
right?
A general use one that wouldn't have any bells and whistles, but that's not what you're looking for right now. And you can get those for $15-$20.
Right. And if you want to spend a little bit more, you can get the one that Alex Slias recommends highly. We've had a whole show on this. The September 7th show of 2016, Alex and I talked about the Ubiquiti Edge Router X, which has kind of hit the world by storm because it has a lot of advanced features, really great for home routing. If you want to listen to that show, go up to geekspeak.org and it's the 0907.
Right. If, so if you have a Netgear R7000, R6400, R8000, that includes 7000P, R7500, 7800, 8500, 9000.
Get on.
Don't wait. This is
bad.
This is bad.
Your whole network
is
compromised.
As bad as it could get for a computing device.
Right. The unfortunate thing, of course, is not a lot of people will know this and what to do about it. And so hopefully Netgear will offer an update relatively soon and people actually update their devices. But I'm not going to hold my breath. Space news.
The brightest ever supernova was discovered in late May of 2015.
We covered on the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's not a supernova.
It isn't?
No. It turns out that it is a supermassive black hole devouring a star.
Oh.
And so as the star goes plunging into the gaping maw, it's getting ripped apart and therefore throwing off a whole lot of energy.
When black holes
and
aren't.
Light. And that light is being focused by the distortion of the black hole's magnetic field.
And it happens to be hitting us.
A gravitational field.
And it happens to be hitting us. Meaning that it's lensing the light and going to one location, and we're in the part of the sky that from it is that location.
Sure,
cool. That's really neat. I remember this supernova, and it's neat to have an update of that. I didn't know it was also an update. That's awesome.
So the link on there also has a neat little artist impression, you know, graphics that go along with it. So.
And of course, we don't know that what it actually looks like, but the pictures are pretty.
Right.
We'll put it on the show for
you. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So partnership between Facebook, Microsoft, Twitter, and YouTube just emerged on December 5th. They announced it. They're actually announcing on Facebook's newsroom. And generally, this is for looking at content that promotes terrorism. So imagery, videos, audio, whatnot, that's used for recruitment in terrorist organizations. And what these organizations are doing, what Facebook, Microsoft, Twitter, and YouTube are doing, are creating a unique hash of this content, and then sharing that hash amongst each other, and they will move that content from their services. So YouTube won't provide it on the service, mm-hmm. Facebook won't provide it and all that. They're basically working together to try to detect content that they want to censor.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Anyway, I think it's neat to have organizations do this. Of course, it's one of those things where the downside of this is that they have a system in place where they can easily remove content from all these services. And who defines what that content should be removed? Them.
Right. And this now goes into the next level of the computing arms race. Because when you make a fingerprint, that means that doing a quick share becomes harder. I don't know about much harder. It means that you're going to start seeing programs that are altering some video in some way. Like, for example, I noticed online when I was looking to see, hey, is the 13th Warrior available anywhere I want to go? And I'm seeing it show up on YouTube. I'm like, what's this is odd. Mm-hmm. Oh, I guess maybe they just didn't. And how I was able to find it was they had altered the movie so that it cropped it and had a nice big black border around the outside. And that is probably enough to throw off the fingerprinting.
The most recent tactic I've seen to get rid of the fingerprinting is to upload the video faster by some amount. And then when you're playing it back, you just slow it down. So that does it too. Right. Of course, uploading it slower would be better because then you have higher quality. They also, this news story by Facebook also says that, you know, each of the companies is also going to be able to submit content, the hashes in, and then they'll all decide on whether they'll filter them out. They'll use it as part of their metric or their algorithms to remove it. And they'll also, they say they will comply with government requests around this kind of thing, which means like other copyright infringement requests, things of that nature. But they'll also... they'll make it transparent or ability to say, no, this content's not a problem, right? There will be a grievance process as well, which is good that they're doing that. And they'll also retain, it will have its own appeal process for removal decisions and grievances from the actual blacklist system as well.
So as you speak of that, Twitter has reinstated Richard Spencer's account.
Who's Richard Spencer?
He is the... head of the National Policy Institute think tank, and this is associated with the alt-right movement, and he is a leading figure. In fact, the person who coined the term, and he is a white nationalist.
Oh, I see. Okay. And his account was blocked by Twitter?
Yes.
He had multiple
accounts, and he was using them concurrently in a way that could be used for what's called dogpiling on Twitter.
So wait, I'm not familiar with the term dogpile. Oh, as in attacking a person from a lot of different angles.
Yes.
Gotcha. And so he was using some of his accounts for that, and they got blocked or got stopped by Twitter because Twitter actually detected that this was not something that they wanted to support.
Well, having multiple accounts and using them in this way is against their policy, their terms of use. And so they dumped him, and there was much rejoicing. And then on Saturday evening, Twitter announced it were reinstating it with verification, saying here's a public figure and this is an official account.
Oh.
And there's been a lot of gnashing of teeth since then, because with regard to hate speech, people are saying like you're supposed to be banning hate speech, and when you're talking about someone who is a white supremacist, what speech does he have that isn't based on hate? Like, that's his sole reason for having fame and notoriety, is the fact that he is the head of a white nationalist organization that believes in white supremacy and that the country, the U.S., should belong to those of Northern European descent. No comment yet back from Twitter about it.
About why they turned it back on.
Right.
So specifically, Spencer's account was suspended mid-November as part of a kind of a larger thing to get rid of alt-right accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter basically claimed that the reason why it was banned or removed was because of a technicality creating multiple accounts with overlapping uses, which is against Twitter's policy.
Yeah.
And they have that policy so that you can't do dogpiling, as you said.
Right.
If they weren't citing specific reasons that his content was hate speech on their account, you could go ahead and be like horrible in every single way, but then on Twitter be talking about daisies. And then your account on Twitter is not hate speech. So does he do stuff on Twitter that is hate speech?
Yes.
Okay.
Or at least by many people's definitions. And he also retweets things that are objectively hateful, or at least according to their terms of services. In other words, they've banned people that he has retweeted.
So basically, the reason why they turned him off was not because he was a hateful person or doing hate speech. They turned him off on this technicality of multiple accounts. Mm-hmm. He was able to resolve that technicality by just canceling all the other accounts, keeping one account.
Or at least, no, he actually is pushing to have his other accounts restored.
Okay.
So we'll see how that goes. But
so he got a letter, or the quote of a letter, and in the second paragraph of this, please select one account for resolution. The others will remain suspended. This account will need to comply fully with the Twitter rules. Please reply this email with username and so on. So it sounds like they reinstated this account because of the multiple account potentiality. So do they have a policy against hate speech?
They do. What is defined as hate speech seems to be different for Jack Dorsey and others who are in charge of Twitter, and many people who have been on the receiving end of abuse on Twitter.
One of the things that this article also talks about, this of course is an article from BuzzFeed that we're quoting, we'll have a link to from geekspeak.org, that their policy about taking out white nationalists' accounts or racist accounts, I don't mm-hmm. know what the best language to use here is. They decided
racist, Nazi, it all works.
Yeah. They permanently suspended Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, Twitter suggested the decision is stemmed from the account being used to incite followers to harass people.
Yes.
Right?
The tweet in particular that got him banned was when someone saying this is harassment, his response was some people deserve to be harassed.
When they terminate an account like that, though, the process of which they do is not a transparent process. And this is one of those things that every time we talk about limiting speech on services or controlling how the service decides what is valuable and what not, like our former story, the concern is who makes the rule, who decides, because that is a lot of power to control voice.
Yes.
Now, of course, this is a private service, right? This company is a private company. It can do anything it wants, just like Facebook and so on. However, these services also have a responsibility to in public discourse. They're used as a primary source of communication form throughout the world. So them being opaque is concerning. At the same time, turning back on the account that is potentially going to incite people to bigotry and hatred doesn't seem like the best decision.
There are definitely a vocal group that are not happy with this.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Do you think that they should Twitter should have a more restrictive policy on banning accounts?
Here's the thing. When you're talking about speech, people are justifiably concerned about stifling speech just because you don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. I do, however, think that there are ideologies that it goes beyond just you have a difference of opinion or you have a policy, conflict, that type of thing. If you, for example, crosses are fine, and if you wear a cross, that is actually speech. That's mm-hmm. that's your religious speech. And fire is generally okay. And if you don't set anyone on fire, fire
you don't hurt anybody or other people's property.
But the Supreme Court has held that a burning cross on someone's lawn is not a protected form of free speech.
Yes, but
because it has a history, it has an aspect to it that is more than just speech.
We're not talking about where the burning cross happened. We're talking about the process of burning cross. Like, I mean, of course, on someone else's land, that's trespassing, right?
Right.
But on your own land, right next to a neighbor or something like that, that is still problematic. Because what does the court say?
What has the Supreme Court said? That it is not protected speech.
Specifically because of its history
yes.
and its context of threat.
Yes.
That it is the equivalent of threat.
Right. And so when I see things like Richard Spencer being put back up on Twitter, it brings to mind this notion that, well, it's just speech. Really, the only way I can think you would believe that it's just speech is if you are in a demographic that feels no threat from it.
Right.
And this was an argument that came up in the Supreme Court decision where you had
Just let me interrupt for just a second. The responsibility of feeling threat is of the person that's feeling threatened, right? Can't anybody feel threatened of anything? You and I have talked before about the benefit we give to our fellow citizens when we're walking down the street. If there's someone that's smaller right. than us, especially a right. female and walking, we cross the street so that we kind of help them not feel threatened in a lot of ways, right? Because we are threatening in general right. to some people. So where is that line of what is threat and what is not threat, and who decides if it is?
That is one of the counterarguments that's put forward, like how do you decide what threat is?
I'm trying to do my job here as a host.
And what you're talking about with regard to white supremacy is a specific goal of disenfranchising everyone who is non-white, having them migrate against their will to some other location. Mm-hmm. To have their economic prospects dashed, which is going to affect their personal life. It is – yes, you are correct that when you have to decide where the line is drawn with regard to threat, yes, that is going to be fuzzy and you have to figure out where this is. But there is also this case where the threat that comes along with the speech and ideology is so far from that line,
yeah.
however ill-defined it may be, mm-hmm. that you don't really have that same problem figuring out if it's acceptable or not. It's like saying, well, how much fire is acceptable fire? You know, the fire on a mat, let's say you're not in any place that's overtly flammable.
a lighter.
Right.
A Bic lighter.
If you have a match, mm-hmm. you're like, okay, people are accepting that. You have a Bic lighter. That's pretty accepting of that. If you carry a torch, people are like, yeah, you know, that's less safe than a lighter, but people would still consider as long as you're not in the woods, you know, like, okay, mm-hmm. this is okay. If you had a tank of gasoline with, you know, a wicked rag
hanging out of it
with the fire coming off of it. Yes. Yeah. That becomes a very different thing that you're talking about. You can talk about what is a safe thing, but you can also point out that this other thing is absolutely not on anywhere near the line of safe.
But okay, so both those things have clear lines of problem in speech, if you will, if you think of the gas tank as speech or mm-hmm. the burning cross as speech, those are both highly physical and clearly dangerous things right off the bat, right? Mm-hmm. Historically from the cross perspective and actually from the tank of gas perspective. But what you're basically saying is that though there is a line that can be flexible in where the definition of clear threat to anybody and not clear threat to anybody moves back and forth, when you have a historic case like in the United States mm-hmm. of violence towards suppressed peoples, then that line becomes very much more clear. And from a practical perspective, it is threat.
This is not just the U.S. because when you're talking about ideologies, ideologies based upon race, based upon religion, are so prevalent and some of the most pernicious forms that even today when you look at Crimea and Ukraine, yep. the conflict there, there is some element of this, that ideology is not just a difference of opinion when you bring in this supremacist argument or an argument that an entire block of people by association are inferior or themselves a threat just by being members of this group. Mm-hmm. And you might want to flip that and say, well, aren't you doing that to white nationalists? And the thing is, white nationalism is a voluntary joining. Like, you can decide today I'm a white nationalist and tomorrow I am no longer a white nationalist, and people have done this. But I can't choose to stop being a person of color tomorrow. I can't. Many people who have grown up their entire lives in the tradition of Islam can't really effectively choose, at least not in terms of with their own private thoughts and beliefs, choose to stop being a Muslim tomorrow. Mm-hmm. That becomes a difference there when you're talking about an association.
Can you first off, I want to acknowledge to our listeners that we're a tech show.
Yeah.
And I've gotten feedback recently that we, not necessarily complaint, but
asking if we are getting more political.
Are we doing more political? And I think the reason why we're becoming more political is because the show is about what we're interested in and engaged in. And right now we're overwhelmed with the state of the world and what's going on. And that's important to us. Mm-hmm. And so you and I are just both interested in talking about these topics. At the same time, I'm also more interested, I have to say, in having interesting conversations on this program and exploring what we think about than going by a rigid definition of what the historic part of the program is. And over the years, we've talked about a lot of things. So,
yeah, if you look at the archives, we're
mostly geeky.
Well, yes, but we've never shied away from politics.
That's right.
We've
brought
it up on a regular basis.
So let's talk for a second about you use the term white nationalism when you want to give them some leeway to some degree, in the sense that you gave them their self-claimed identity as a white nationalist. What does white nationalism mean? Does white nationalism, does the national side mean the United States?
They do lay, or at least these specific white nationalists do lay claim to the U.S. White nationalism is treating your ethnic group, if you are white, for example, or at least in this case, as a cohesive group.
Like a nation?
Yes, but
you see what I'm saying? Like, I just don't really understand, like, where the national aspect comes from.
Okay. First off, I will say that I am not
an expert
the person.
On
yeah, I'm not. Well, I'm not the person that is going to be as charitable to their position as they might like, and therefore I may get details wrong. They may split hairs on some items.
At the same time, you know how to argue and bring a point, and you should understand a group that you disagree with
right.
at some level.
And white nationalism versus white supremacists versus Nazi, they're not Nazis per se, because Nazis were a specific group in Germany during the 30s and 40s. But much of that same ideology is present in the National Policy Institute. And when they like to say white nationalist rather than white supremacist, and yet at the same time, whenever I've seen speeches by Richard Spencer, he has talked about how whites are responsible for essentially for all that is good and prosperous in our nation, and others have just been along for the ride and taken advantage of that brilliance.
So he's a bad historian, is what you're saying.
And so I tend to use them interchangeably, even though he says, we're not white supremacists, we're white nationalists, and let other groups be on their own, and we'll take care of ourselves.
White supremacists, I understand that ideology really clearly. White nationalists, to me, what's the nation? I'm caught up on this word. What is that? Why are they using the word nation? They want a nation state of white people? Is that?
Yes.
Because that, there's no, in my mind, when you say it that way, there's no separation between supremacy ideology.
I didn't think there would be either. Okay. But I mean,
so maybe you and I don't understand their perspective, or maybe we're so vehemently against their perspective as being, have any kind of rationale, that we can't accept it as it's a falsehood in our eyes. Yeah?
Perhaps.
How do we get off on that topic? Oh, because Twitter turned on this account again.
Right.
So this Richard Spencer dude, is he doing stuff that is clearly against their policy, or do they not have a good hate filter policy? What's the rule for Twitter?
That's the thing. It's
opaque.
It's what Twitter decides is hate speech or abusive or bullying.
And do they, if you were to go do bullying or hate speech on your Twitter account and somebody at Twitter noticed it, because that, of course, has to happen, right? Would they delete that entry or two and give you a warning, or they turn off your account? What's the rule? What's the process there?
I have seen over the years both. I've seen some people just knocked off because it was considered egregious enough that they were just dumped. I've seen others being given warnings. I've seen others that had their accounts taken away for a short period of time, I guess a cool-off period. I think that variance is actually legitimate, considering the fact that Twitter is making something that doesn't really have a previous historical example.
Right.
They're working things along as they go. You know, the Twitter community is changing over time, both diversifying and also reacting to the policies of the Twitter executive staff. At the same time, as I said, many of their decisions, especially with regard to Richard Spencer, seem very much in line with the thinking of, well, I don't consider it a threat myself.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal belief is that it's because they are of a group where they don't understand, they don't have any personal stake in why it would be a threat.
Right.
In much the same way that there have been many accounts that they were very slow to react to the Gamergate.
They're still slow on a lot of that stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that had very much to do with the fact that to someone who is male, a lot of these attacks don't feel the same.
Right.
If another guy said these things to you, they don't feel the same, and you can't think of it as though you are another guy. You have to think of it in terms of empathy. Have to think of it in terms of the recipient.
It has, in some ways, it has to do with privilege. You're blind to the privilege you have.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Speaking of Twitter, have you heard of Sick of Wolves?
I have not.
Okay. Sick of Wolves is an account. That's the Sick of Wolves on Twitter, mm-hmm. @SickofWolves, all one word. And this is clearly a wolf pretending to be a person.
Like you do.
Like you do. So if you were a wolf in the society, of course, you would try to pretend like you're a person, and that's the account. And so the account has the surname, if you will, of Not a Wolf. It's hilarious. I highly recommend it. And while you're on Twitter, go ahead and follow Miles Elam. He is simply at Miles Elam, one word, and I'm at Lyle, just L-Y-L-E. So please do feel free to follow us.
Yeah, Lyle got on quick, so he was able to get at Lyle. I joined much, much later, and so all I could get was my full name rather than just at Miles.
When did you start?
November 2009. I tend to be late to the social media.
Yeah. February 2007. That's still pretty late too. That's when I started.
I think I only got on Facebook in 2008, and there were quite a few people on there before then.
And of course, if you'd like to hear about anything or read more about anything we're talking about, please visit geekspeak.org. We love to have reviews and people spread the word. Please feel free to do that. And of course, if you want to support us directly financially, you can visit us and support our Patreon page anytime you'd like. You can learn all about that at geekspeak.org. Support for the area to support us. Let's talk about Uber.
Yes.
I use Uber, and I recently heard someone having a disaster story about an Uber experience, and that's rare for me, but I'm sure it does at some level happen.
Yes, there have been lawsuits about it, but then again, there's lawsuits with any large organization that come out, so especially a disruptive technology. What is different about this, and this comes into tech companies and their influence combined with their social responsibility that goes along with it, is that a former employee of Uber has claimed that Uber employees on a, I don't know about a regular basis, I don't want to characterize it that way because I don't know how widespread it is between employees, mm-hmm. Or whether it was a few that do it or a lot of them that do it a little bit, you know.
Sure.
But they were using the Uber platform and the data sets they have within the company because, you know, they have to have access to the data sets to be able to work on them and work on the applications and get them working correctly. We're using the platform to stalk celebrities and their exes. In other words, whenever you know, celebrities, ex-girlfriends, boyfriends, other, and so they look up, oh, hey, Beyonce got on to, got an Uber, and where's she going? And basically what we would consider a gross invasion of privacy and something that doesn't happen with, that didn't happen with taxis because they were very much, you call a phone, you say, I want a taxi to show up, and then someone gets in and they take them there. And so there could be some reporting of one off from a cab driver who could then get in trouble or, or like there was some accountability. Here you have this bird's eye view of the data.
So I've always been curious about that with systems of that nature, because, of course, an employee at Uber that has database rights can theoretically look up any person by their email address and find out all the locations they've been to and from.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, of course, they set up the system such that people can't make that request or that search. There is policies at companies, like at Google, for example, you have tons of people's data, like email accounts and things of that nature, right? As an employee, you could just go in and look at people's email, right? No, not even close, right?
One, you had to have access to that specific set, a data set, to be able to do queries, and they always made sanitized data sets that you could work with to be able to look at stuff without seeing user identifiable information. So obviously that was a lower security level, lower threat level. But if you did have access to the raw data sets, and
there are reasons to have it, right?
Right. Yeah. And I did it
at one point.
But they log all queries. Mm-hmm. So they can tell, like, hey, you're looking for a specific ID, and you know, they may look, if you're looking at your own ID, that's also a different thing than you're looking at your ex-girlfriend's ID, you know.
And I would assume that
people
that is,
were fired.
Yeah, yeah, fired. And I would assume
fired
also that,
and prosecuted.
And I would assume also that in your on take to work at the company, that's talked about a lot.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's something I wonder about different companies. Some companies like Google, especially with their data sets, it becomes obvious, as it were. Like, you need to secure this. You can't just let random employees break that trust. But then I also think of companies like Uber. Were they even looking at that as a problem?
Right.
Before, so do they have any of those safeguards?
That's the thing, is they, as they start up, they're small and everybody trusts each other and they're all working together as a goal. And then slowly, quickly, actually, they become thousands and thousands of people. And everyone has their own motivation. They're all human. And if you didn't set that up at some point, it's not going to be there.
Right. And even if you have a core group of people, say it's, you know, six friends getting together and making great, you know, new site, you have to recognize that we're talking about human beings here. Human beings don't always act right. I know I have plenty of instances in my background where I was growing up doing, wow, I really shouldn't have done that.
Sure.
That was, I look back at it and cringe and say, like, that was just wrong. There was, I was curious, or I felt hurt, or whatever the motivation was.
Or also having potentially good motivations. We did a Secret Santa thing at work at Netflix, right? And so I actually got my boss, like a director position person. That was the name I pulled. And I was trying to figure out what would be a good gift to give him. Like, I know him, you know, we have meetings together. We have lunch, you know, I know him. But I'm not close enough, as all colleagues, you know, you're like, you have a level of respect and everything. I didn't have anything that was like, I know exactly what I'll get him, right? And so at one point I joked about, well, I can just look at what kind of movies he likes, right? Because, of course, we have access to each other's movie watching data on Netflix. And that, to me, like, immediately gave me a gut reaction of, no, that's not good.
Right.
don't look at what people do, because that's creepy and gross. But I could easily see that being, like, because the thought process, of course, was to do something nice for him. So
at best, it's creepy and gross.
Yeah.
At worst, you can actually do damage to other people. You can get blackmail material. You can get things that can compromise, you know, if you have that information.
And to be clear, I have never done that at work, and I don't think of any of my colleagues that have ever done that at work. Like, that's not something we do.
But what safeguards are present? This is true of Facebook. This is true of Netflix. It's true of any system that you have set up that people, especially employees, people that you may not know personally outside of the workplace, although knowing someone outside the workplace is not a defense either.
Sure.
There needs to be some type of accounting.
Yeah.
Even if you're not stopping them from doing it, there should be some type of audit trail.
Right. Well, so to be very clear, that the way that, you know, when somebody calls up and let's say, for example, medical records. You know, if you ever call and make an appointment at a doctor's office, they ask you your name and stuff you started, and then they ask you for your date of birth. They always ask for date of birth. This is a confirmation process. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the system that they're using, without putting in the proper date of birth, the records won't unlock. Mm-hmm. So they can't look at it unless – now, of course, that person on the phone could have written down your information and later looked at it, right? So it's not like a perfect strategy, but it's a part of a determinant system that can help.
Right.
So that's what they're kind of doing.
A lot of
the
stuff isn't meant to be like an absolute. You're not talking about someone – a determined attacker inside of a company.
Forget about it.
Will try to cover up their tracks. And depending on how good the system is to be able to get that, you know, to alter the audit logs or whatever, depending upon how well you've secured that, you know, do you send your logs to an external site where they're archived and cannot be manipulated, that type of thing. But that takes effort to set up, and it takes expense that many companies don't feel that they can take.
Well, it's just something to think about that, you know, when you say I'm going to share my location information with Uber, when that decision happens on the phone, mm-hmm. you're not just saying...
Coupled with your user account, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And your user account, of course, has your email address, right, and your name, and your credit card information gets associated, right? All this stuff gets associated. You're trusting a corporation, and if you think about the corporation as like, what's the goals? Well, the goals is to make money over time, and if they really, you know, do something horrible to me, I'm going to speak up about it, and it's going to damage their reputation. So it doesn't make any sense for them to do anything horrible to me because it doesn't help the bottom line. You also think that, well... Are they a responsible enough company to make sure that all of their employees who might not have the same kind of larger goal perspective do the right thing? And you can't really, right? So now you're in this place where I hope they did it right. And when I see a story like this, that an employee comes out and whistleblows, I go, cool, in 6 months, it'll be really safe at Uber. Because Uber, of course, at that point has to do a whole bunch of stuff to make sure that this doesn't happen again. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they should have done in the first place. So it never did happen. And now they will.
Right. And hopefully. This is Geek Speak. So let's hit a tech angle here. Let's talk about some things that you can do that mitigate this. Like, one of them is separating out the table of data that has the user accounts with the table of data that has the scheduling information so that you can make queries that join between them. But if you want someone that's just looking to see what scheduling information is like, then don't give them access to the user identifiable information.
So if Uber ran off something like Postgres, like a traditional relational data structure
and
database.
And we are grossly simplifying this, but this is just to get people on board here.
Because they're going to be doing something like Redis or Cassandra or something like that at a larger scale, but it's much more complicated to talk about that. But just from a simple perspective of one database and having access, you set up multiple roles, and you had admin roles, which traditionally can do anything. But you also set up other roles, and the employees that do not need like admin roles, that are like not writing software. In fact, actually, no employee ever needs to have an admin, because what you can do is you can actually give that responsibility to an app that you've coded up that's the source is open to all the employees, and that app has responsibilities and certificates to run things, and it's restricted by the code that's written, and that code, of course, before it's submitted and used, is reviewed by lots of developers. So now you're trusting a larger pool of people, and normally when people get together as a larger pool, they do kind of the right thing for the group, if you will, which of course is the right thing for the business at this time.
Right, mm-hmm. And there is a business case for doing this, for involving more people, because the naive thought is, well, I have two programmers. I want them to be working on separate things so I can get twice as much done. But that's not how it ends up working, because they need to be able to get their systems to work together and stuff like that. So things slow down. There actually is a fair amount of data that says that things like pair programming do work, where two people are sitting, one person is the driver, writing in the code, and the other person is watching what the other person is doing And so that second person becomes familiar with what's going on and is able to say, wait, why are you doing that? To start a discussion to find out, oh, I'm learning this new technique, or that there is something that is a potential fault.
And traditionally, of course, in pair programming, what you do is you actually swap keyboards back and forth. So mm-hmm. a person takes a turn, then the next person takes a turn. And sometimes this works pretty well, because if you're typing a lot, like if you're doing some horrible language like Java, you could actually type a lot. It makes sense that while the person's typing, you're kind of checking it, you know what they're doing, and the other person's thinking, okay, well, next we're going to have a class like this, and they're kind of thinking, and then the keyboard gets passed back, and the other person has to write all this crappy Java.
Yeah, nice take against Java. That's why IDEs were created, to be able to do that quickly. But anyway.
By the way, I do a lot of Groovy development, which, of course, is
Java light.
Groovy's like, wow, Java should be better. Let's make Groovy. And then the Java people are like, good idea. And they put all that stuff in Java. So you don't need Groovy anymore, but it's like there anyway. It's kind of annoying. And of course, those really great things that you wanted to work, like, I don't know, private methods and things, actually aren't private in Groovy. You can actually use them even though they're declared private. It's right. Really frustrating. So I'm actually kind of poo-pooing Groovy at this point.
Well, Groovy also straddled that line with Python, as we get more into tech, straddle that line with Python. For example, Python doesn't have anything like a privacy.
Right.
They have a convention, which is you use underscores before the variable name.
Common convention.
And so
in general.
People just and
okay. To be really yeah. clear, okay. First off, when I first met Miles, I was just a scripter, right? I just did Perl script and VB script, and Miles started teaching me Java, and actually, of course, I did Pascal and stuff in school, but. I remember like lessons of Java. So over the years, you've been like this Java guru to me in some ways. And at the same time, whenever I'm in a Java environment, I feel like it's so verbose and frustrating. You have to declare everything. And, you know, I'm a JavaScript person. I love JavaScript. Then I move in Objective-C and I'm like, if only there was Groovy. I mean, Java. not really. I'm actually like Objective-C a lot. But anyway, it's kind of fun to talk about this. But let's talk real quickly about what privacy means in respect to classes and public methods and so on. Should we do the car thing or no?
Sure.
Yeah?
Because people use the car analogy just because that's the one that's really easy for people to understand.
But it's so boring, Miles. I don't want to do the car thing again. Let's do something else.
Boring for us, not for the people who need to learn this. But do you have another analogy you want to use? It's fine.
Let's at least do like a bicycle or wheel, like that kind of thing.
The bicycle I don't like using because you can see the parts really easily.
Okay,
that's the whole
okay.
point.
Nothing's
behind
private.
The car, yeah.
All right. So you got when you're doing object-oriented programming design, you conceptualize things into their own discrete pieces. You call those objects. So for example, a car would have – the object would be called car, and it would have methods on it like drive or steer. Is this mm-hmm. good? Are you doing okay?
Yes. All right. Or more specifically, the interface to that object would have, accelerate, brake, turn.
Add gasoline.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there'd be no method in the car to remove gasoline, because that's actually not part of the interface of a car. You drive the car, and that decreases gasoline amount in the vehicle. But you don't actually have a public way of saying remove gasoline. Unless, of course, you got a hose and you don't mind getting really sick.
That's where analogies fall down. You don't necessarily know how that BMW handles steering. Like,
okay,
is it rack and pinion? Right. Is it,
Right. What you mean, like, when you take the steering wheel and you shift it to the left, that's the method of steer left. Let's say we
right.
have that. And so you do that with your hands, you steer it, and the vehicle does turn left. But the actual complexity between it turning left and you turning the wheel is not something you need to know about.
Right.
So there might be seven different things in
right,
the way.
Right. How much camber is involved with the wheel settings, toe in, toe out, things like that.
That's all just part of the system and you don't have to worry about it.
Right. And you hit the accelerator pedal. What happens? On older cars, you press the accelerator pedal. It opens up the carburetor, lets more gas into the engine.
Right. There's actually a little wire, basically like a hard rod that goes up to another thing that rotates slightly, and that actually does exactly what you mm-hmm. just said. And at the same time, in newer cars, there's fuel injectors, right? So mm-hmm. there's a computer that says we need more fuel. Same kind of process,
right.
But it's not done the same way.
Right. And then you have things like the Prius,
well,
where they are truly fly-by-wire. You press the pedal, even though it gives you resistance, physical resistance, it's not actually telling the fuel injector to inject more gas.
It's telling
actually
the computer
saying,
that I want
the
to
computer
use
saying, okay, use some combination of the electric motor and the gas engine.
Let's not get too complicated about that computer, because we're talking about this whole thing as a program called a car. and the interfaces, you know, accelerate. And your point is that there's another method in there somewhere that might be like open carburetor, right? But that method is actually a private method, meaning right. that you don't want the individual user to say open carburetor, because that would, you could do that, right? You could open the right. hood and
not,
like kind
not
of,
unless you're debugging.
Right. And so that method, open carburetor, is a completely private method. And you never make it public, because if you drive a car and I drive a car and I'm driving an old, old car, my car does have an open carburetor. Mm-hmm. rule in it, right? It does exist. Mm-hmm. But if I learned to use open carburetor when I upgraded to your Prius, I would look for open carburetor and it wouldn't work and I couldn't drive. Mm-hmm. And so that's the difference between a public interface and a private interface. Groovy allows you to call that open carburetor, even though you said make it private.
Right.
And Python the same way, except that it would be underscore open carburetor.
Right, which is the idea is that you have a panel of switches. And you have the ones that are very clearly marked. And then you have a bunch of switches, little tiny buttons elsewhere that have little stickers on them that say, don't use, don't mm-hmm. use, don't use, don't use. And the ones you do are supposed to use, their stickers are larger, nice, big type. And it's very clear which things you're supposed to be using.
You know, speaking of this, last week you were saying, oh yeah, downloads of Netflix is great and all that, but I really want to be able to play from the beginning on my iPad or Android device, whatever. When I was talking about that, I said, there's actually a way to automatically start a movie from the beginning. There's an interface for that.
Yes.
So I talked to a big boss person at Netflix and said, hey, can I tell people how that system works and why don't we have documentation? I wanted to find documentation so I could link it to you. Mm-hmm. I actually sent you a sample so you could do this yourself. I don't know if you – did you do that?
I actually didn't.
Okay. Well, anyway, it works if you want to. But this interface to do that, it's called deep linking, ability to open mm-hmm. a display page or whatever in Netflix. That exists. And it exists because we do things like email people, hey, a new season started. And then they get the email. They click on their email – on uh-huh. their computer, and it will open up and it will go right to that new season of the show, right? That's a really nice feature right. to have. And so we use it in different ways. You can also share inside an app. You can share a title, whatever. And we have the ability to start playback at a certain point. But all of that interface, as my boss person told me, Sam says to me, well, we do have that, but we don't make that public because then it's a public interface that we have to have responsibility to. Like, we use it.
Which is why Netflix dropped all of their third-party API
support. API stuff. Well, it's kind of that. The idea that if you make a public interface for programmers to do things in, then you're making a contract with them that you always keep that available. And so we don't publish this feature set because we don't want to be in a situation where we're supporting it indefinitely. What if we want to do it a different way, a better way for our business model in the future? If that's the case, we might not use this anymore. We might deprecate it. And when you make something public to people, like the pushing the gas pedal, you don't want to then make a car that doesn't have that gas pedal because the interface is completely different. People have to relearn how to drive. And that's kind of the reason why I'm not going to describe exactly how that works. But it's really easy to find out if you want to play with it.
Sure.
Just know that don't write any software on it because you don't know how long it will actually work.
Mm-hmm.
What was the thing that we put on the queue for getting back to?
Well, talking about how to... examples of how you would restrict access to personalized data, you know, how you have a culture within a company that protects user privacy.
Oh, I see. Okay. I didn't know we were going to go back to that. I thought we kind of covered that. The idea
well,
is that
we got sidetracked onto the languages. And so
you design your data structure in some ways to segregate. You were saying have like a user table where, you know, you can still send email to the person. You can look up their name in case they call with a complaint. Mm-hmm. And then credit card information, of course, is in another area, which probably you wouldn't want to have people have access to. And then you'd have like the session information, like all the driving history.
Well, there's that. Or another possibility, which is a very common one, is you have the live data set that has all the information. And with the knowledge of what that database schema, the structure of the database looks like, you write a script that takes that data out and puts it without the user specific information into a separate database. And that's the database that people develop off of.
Mm-hmm. And at Netflix, for example, we have the public database and then mm-hmm. we have a test database. And they are separate databases and they're test separate environments. And you can actually switch between the two of them. And when you switch around that test environment, everything's just false. Like, I mean, it's data that you can look at and use, but it doesn't actually represent people.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of cool for exactly that reason.
Right. One of the nice things about having a data set that is as large as Netflix or another large company is that The variance within the actual data set means that when you randomize stuff in your private data set, it actually is fairly representative of reality.
Mm-hmm.
You can get back to the mean. When you have a more a smaller group of people and from a very specific demographic, you find a lot of trends that doesn't work as well as randomization. Right. These are tools you can do. If you write that script, if you write that process for extracting from a public database to
and translating into anonymized.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or having that heuristic in there. If you can do that, then you can isolate yourself and your employees. The person who wrote the script can isolate themselves
right.
from it, automate the process so that it happens, you know, a data dump every certain period of time so that you never have to have access to that. And then it becomes much easier to be able to say, all right, and whenever you want to access this privilege information, which is that data set, make rules around it. You can have, you know, sign-ins for it. You can have an audit, you know, logging on that. And you have fewer people that need to have access to it. So it becomes a more rare, a rare instance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That can be controlled.
Yeah. Another way to think about it.
I was just trying to make up for all the politics and try to get a bit more geeky.
I see another politics story coming up that looks pretty bad, so I definitely want to do more tech. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that we made it. Thanks to Michael Newman of PetStar Music for our theme song, and thanks to Greg Merkley, who gave us today's working title, Uber-hating router didn't go Nova on Twitter.